Good morning. This is At Issue on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm Victor Mandolia. I'm your host for the show today, and I'm with Deborah Gilbert. Thank you for joining us this morning. And
nice to be here.
Talking about we are going to pretend that it's December 1st. December 1st is officially World AIDS Day in throughout the world. And I think it started with A Day Without Art, which is a group that was called Visual AIDS. I know that Hunter is a part of that.
Sure.
But through the years, the World AIDS Day has grown into a worldwide day of action around HIV and AIDS. The president held a press conference about HIV AIDS services, and many leaders around the world did the same. I believe that the UN is the organization that has declared World AIDS Day, and this was the 25th anniversary of World AIDS Day this past Sunday. Most municipalities or most governments celebrated it on the Monday the 2nd, but we're going to pretend that it's World AIDS Day today and talk a little bit about people that we've lost and how people are surviving and working toward a cure now. We're particularly going to focus on the impact that HIV and AIDS had on the cultural community, the artist communities, in all respects. But we'll also be talking about the global AIDS and the fight against HIV and AIDS as well. So do you have any thoughts to start off the show?
25 years is a quarter century.
Yes, absolutely.
Can that many years have passed?
It's amazing.
And it's important to remember how uncertain things were when GRID and strange symptoms started occurring, mm-hmm. mostly in the gay community, but also in the hemophiliac community.
Yeah.
And other groups with impaired immune problems.
So you mentioned GRID. So before there was the term AIDS, and way before HIV was a term that was used to talk about what HIV and AIDS became. It was called GRID, which stood for Gay Related Immune Deficiency, because at the time in this country, the only cases that people were seeing were in gay men, and although there may have been other cases that they didn't make the connections of, but there was there had been an increase in strange cancers.
Carpentier sarcoma comes to mind.
Yeah, exactly, and these illnesses that had before only really been seen in elderly people, people who had immune compromised systems because they were elderly,
or maybe on chemotherapy.
Right, exactly. They started being seen particularly in San Francisco and in New York, and the CDC came up with this classification. Later it became AIDS, which stands for AIDS Immunity Immune Deficiency Syndrome, and HIV is human immunovirus. HIV is the virus which causes AIDS. So you were in New York at the time, at the worst of the crisis, as was I. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your thoughts about that time.
I'm thinking of one friend in particular who died at a very early age in his 40s. He was extremely successful and a vibrant personality, and no one knew what he died of. They said it was hepatitis, and, you know, he may have had that too. But AIDS was not on the horizon then. You know, he was probably my first friend to come down with it.
Where were you living at the time?
In the Village.
Uh-huh.
And
which was ground zero for HIV and AIDS.
Yeah, that in San Francisco.
Right.
You know, another thought is we started to see the books of Armistead Maupin, and he was someone who published, like Charles Dickens, in a serial way in the San Francisco Chronicle, and dealt with both plots about gay and straight people, and AIDS certainly figures large in his plot line as time went on, and you know, he got to the later books in his series. I'm thinking of Alison Gertz, the daughter of a prominent New York family who was just a teen when she came down with AIDS after one single encounter with a bartender she had a crush on at Studio 54. And we wouldn't know anything about her except she very bravely went public with her story. You know, she said, you know, so far we've read about poor people and gays getting this disease, mm-hmm. but this happened to me, and you can't ignore this story. It can happen to anyone. And the fact, you know, the fact that it could happen after one sexual encounter is just, you know, it makes life seem so unfair.
I mean, and that was really where, I mean, I was in my 20s and when during the peak of the AIDS crisis in the 80s, and the strange thing, I think, for younger people today to understand the way that life was at the time was that we were living in a time when you could have any number of your friends in their 20s and 30s just drop dead, like in a matter of months or weeks even sometimes. And I think it was like, you know, a lot of people compared it to living in a war where people just all of a sudden aren't there anymore. And in many respects, it really was like living in a battlefield in a war where your friend who was there today is gone tomorrow. And for some people, I was lucky. I only lost about, you know, three very close friends, but for many people, they lost dozens and dozens and dozens of friends. And I think while the advances are really amazing and great that we now have treatments for HIV and we're able to live productive lives, we can't forget where we came from and what that time was like, because it's so important to understand the depth of the crisis and the loss that
the story of Hunter Reynolds is interesting, because the arts community was hit disproportionately. Hunter Reynolds is a world-renowned performance artist who took as the subject matter for his performance art the AIDS crisis. Mm-hmm. And if you were to Google Hunter, a picture of him, and he was a very attractive, statuesque, model-type guy, the son of an actor. And he's dressed in a diaphanous, strapless gown that is printed with the names of AIDS victims. Mm-hmm. And he performed on a platform where he just twirled for, you know, the time that the gallery was open. In my book, he's up there with Marina mm-hmm. Abramovich mm-hmm. In his kind of endurance-driven art form.
And he shows at PPOW Gallery, right? Which
yes.
which was the gallery that David Wojnarowicz was associated with as well. And David is probably the most well-known gay artist, person who lived with HIV really rose out of the East Village art scene. That was a huge burst of artistic energy in the 80s. Wojnarowicz was the first person from that scene to be shown at the Whitney Biennial, and although I think there were a number of others actually before that, and the more I think about it, but certainly the most embraced of the people talking about AIDS and HIV through their work.
Mm-hmm. Now, when did he die?
I can tell you that in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
I have to look
now,
back.
Hunter is still alive, and
right.
in spite of having a stroke that was caused by AIDS, it led to some kind of neurological problem. And the first time I met Hunter was because we were living in the same building in Williamsburg, and he asked me to write a check for him because he couldn't even write. But since then, he's recovered considerably and does beautiful photo murals and continues his performance art, which I was at a show of his in 2011, and it was quite an extraordinary show he put on, where he wrapped his body in, I think his attendants, his beautiful naked dancer attendants wrapped him in all sorts of colorful duct tape.
Wanarevich died in 1992, and we in Hudson are about to have a David Wanarevich connection, because the two guys who recently bought the Charles Williams School, not so recently at this point, but the Charles Williams School on Robinson and Third Street, now called Second Ward, is going to be a repository for their art collection, and they have a huge collection of David Wanarevich work. So
that's exciting.
Yeah. So at some point that will materialize. I'm just going to prepare. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about like the art scene and New York at the time. And I'm gonna play us a little track by. I'll tell you what I'm going to play when I get back.
Just to put the sort of beginnings of public awareness of AIDS into a historical context. This was going on concurrently to the first Gulf War, Desert Storm. During that time, I was married to the late Michael Ryan, a journalist and a writer, and he was over in the Gulf doing a story on Schwarzkopf, General Schwarzkopf. When he returned, he saw in the Times Union a story about a Boy Scout who had contracted AIDS through a blood transfusion. He was hemophiliac, and he had held a press conference up in Oneonta, backed up by his family and scout troop, and he said, "I've come down with this." He'd been positive for several years, but in his senior year in high school in Cooperstown, he'd come down with full-blown AIDS. And he didn't want to hide it, you know, in spite of what happened to Ryan White, was he a second grader in Florida who was shunned by his community and had to leave? He wanted to go public and tell people about it and show people the face of a straight boy who just got it, too. And when Michael went up to interview him, because he did freelance journalism and he was going to do a story for People magazine, and he said, "I don't want to do a story. I want to make a film about him." So we went up there and we followed Henry during his senior year and during a couple years after that, and made the film Eagle Scout, the story of Henry Nichols. And Eagle Scout refers to the fact that he did his Eagle Scout project by going around and talking to school kids and high schools all over the country and the world and different civic groups. And he wanted to educate people about this thing.
So we're going to play a track by we're going to take a little break and then come back and continue our discussion. But I'm going to play a track by Ofra Haza. Ofra Haza was a Yemenite Jew and became well known in the U.S. because Eric B. and Rakim sampled this track that I'm going to play. Ofra Haza never really was open about her HIV or AIDS, you know, AIDS diagnosis. She wound up dying of AIDS, and I think it was released against the wishes of her family. But her music really spoke to many, many, many people and reached a very wide audience outside of Israel and Yemen. So this is Ofra Haza, Imnin Alu.
Thank you.
So that was the great Ofra Haza, one of the many artists and musicians lost to HIV and AIDS during the worst of the crisis. I think one of the important moments in HIV was also the loss of Eazy-E from N.W.A. It was the black community in general hadn't really been on the radar as far as HIV goes, and it was a moment when the black community had a wake up call and realized that it was at risk as well. And of course, Magic Johnson was a bigger moment as well. But so we were just during the break, we were talking a little bit about other people that were lost during the crisis. And one of the biggest influences on the culture and the arts at the time was Robert Mapplethorpe, and Mapplethorpe was a target of Jesse Helms, the senator from North Carolina. There was a large retrospective of his work. I think perhaps it was I think it was the Whitney that.
No, it was in Philadelphia or Ohio. Oh, okay. One of the Midwestern, right, or Northeastern inland.
And it museums. Traveled around. It traveled. Yes. It traveled through to many cities, though. And it was the impetus, as well as a number of other artists as well. But I think Mapplethorpe was the start of the attempt to defund the National Endowment for the Arts over what Jesse Helms described as obscene art. And that was it set up the cultural war, as Pat Buchanan often referred to it at the time. Pat Buchanan, the former presidential candidate and speechwriter for, I guess, Nixon and a number of other presidents. But
it really was quite a cause celebre.
Yeah.
And to be fair, Mapplethorpe was a very powerful artist who dealt in many of his very large, beautiful photographic prints with highly charged homoerotic subject matter.
It definitely pushed boundaries. There's no question.
Yes.
And it set up a discussion of what is art and when do you go too far, and what is legitimate and what is trash.
An ongoing basically. Discussion,
right?
Certainly,
especially here in Hudson. So, I'm doing two things at once. I'm sorry.
You know, there's also the fashion world. Perry Ellis died very early.
Willie
on
Smith was a Willie Smith of Willie Wear. There was
Alexander McQueen.
Yeah,
that was a huge loss.
Well, Alexander McQueen committed suicide somewhat recently, but was HIV positive as well.
Tina Chow, fashion model turned jewelry designer.
Mm-hmm. And
Candace Bushnell is alive but has AIDS, and she was the writer whose book Sex in the City went on to be produced TV series.
I didn't know that.
And then, she started out as the sex reporter for the New York Observer. Occupational hazard.
And then, of course, there were a number of big sports celebrities as well. Arthur Ashe being the first one.
Black tennis player. And he got it from a blood transfusion.
Right. And then, of course, Magic Johnson, Greg Louganis later, the Olympic diver, came out as HIV positive, is still alive. But there was lots of the most creative people in the country and in the world were the ones who were most at risk, actually.
And two writers who should not go unmentioned today are Randy Schiltz, who wrote the band and the band played on,
right,
now deceased, and Paul Monette, who's just a fantastic writer who chronicled the personal loss of his lover.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was like to be a closeted gay man in the 1960s and early 70s in becoming a man, and the last days of his life in Last Watch of the Night, they're all tremendously affecting books.
And Randy Schultz, and the band Play It On was really one of the first plays to deal with HIV and AIDS, along with Larry Kramer's The Normal Heart, which is currently in production on for an HBO film. It should be they're filming right now, and I guess will be out in the spring. So that's that for people who haven't ever seen the play. That will be an opportunity to see The Normal Heart, which is just an incredible piece and really exposes the lack of attention and, in fact, complete inaction by the government at the time. When during the worst of the build up to the worst of the crisis during the late 80s, early 90s was the worst of it, when there was no treatment and there was and the number of infected people kept just exploding without any treatment in sight. Ronald Reagan was president at the time, and never even mentioned the word AIDS until his friend Rock Hudson, the actor, got HIV and or AIDS, and that was a big Reagan was a big target of AIDS activists who had really saw him as just overseeing complete inaction on what would become a global pandemic, and the AIDS activists fought and in some cases chained themselves to offices and in order to shake out the inaction that and the lack of attention that the government and governments all
and
around
lack
the
of
world
funding
right.
And the group ACT UP comes to mind.
Right.
They were very vocal and extremely
relentless.
but Larry Kramer, I cherish for his anger.
Yeah. So we're going to take another quick break. And this is with tongue in cheek, tongue firmly planted in cheek. This is Another One Bites the Dust by Freddie Mercury and Queen.
another one busts the dust.
And that is Queen, led by Freddie Mercury, Another One Bites the Dust. Mercury was one of the first celebrities to acknowledge his that he had AIDS. He, within a matter of, I think it was about like 2 weeks before his death, he first came out as gay, and then issued a... another press release saying that he had AIDS, and shortly thereafter passing away. But he was another one of these seminal moments where people who prior to his announcement, a lot of people didn't know anybody who had AIDS or had HIV, and so in the way that Rock Hudson was one of these people, Magic Johnson was one of these people, Ryan White. The young boy who the most of the HIV and AIDS dollars in this country are provided through the federal dollars anyway, are provided through the Ryan White Act. And so the Congress named the act for Ryan White, who had his house burned down and run out of school and just you know, for just because he had HIV. And you know, there was at the time when that we're talking about, you know, right now we have marriage equality here in our state and in, you know, dozens of others, more than I think it's like 16 or 17 states right now. This was at a time when that was, you couldn't even consider that would even be the case, that it was, you know, our country didn't talk about gay people. If it did, it was in homophobic ways.
We've come a long way.
Yeah, in a very short time. I mean, in the scheme of things, and gay people were in many ways thought of as expendable. When the populations most affected by HIV was intravenous drug users and gay people, gay men, and in society at large, those populations were considered, a lot of people said, well, better off without them, you know, and so
a lot of them were invisible, right, keeping very low profile,
right,
or maybe closeted,
right, and that's something that's a very different scenario now. I mean, over the course of this time, more people came out and as gay and as HIV positive, and when people have personal connections with somebody, that's when their mind gets changed. I mean, I remember in ACT UP, one of the things that people would say all the time is that nothing will change until everybody knows somebody with AIDS. And that's exactly really what happened. I mean, when it was your brother or your cousin or your uncle, then it changed people's attitudes about the disease and about gay people in general. I think that the crisis had much to do with the advances in gay rights that have taken place over the course of time, because now people knew people who were gay,
yeah,
or who had
well,
HIV.
Marriage is a civil right,
right,
and finally people have come to see that. But you know, it's not so long ago that I remember working in an office at Time Inc. and an editor I worked under said, my family looked at an apartment, but we heard that the person who lived there before had died of AIDS, and we turned it down. Can you believe that? You can't catch AIDS from living in an apartment that somebody you had it lived in. And even then, it seemed odd that someone should be so concerned about something like that.
Yeah, it's nuts. So let's see. With all of the advances that we've made in HIV, where do you think that we still have ways to go?
Well, third world countries, they're still safe. You know, condoms just aren't widely available still in third world countries. Even in this country, you know, we have kind of a third world country overlay. Do you remember the story of Keith Haring, the graffiti artist?
Yeah.
It is said that although he was fully aware that he was infected with the virus, he went out and caroused with a lot of his groupies, many of them Latino males who got infected.
And Keith, many of you will know who Keith Haring was, but started as a subway graffiti artist. He would do chalk drawings on the blacked out ads that were in the subways, and many of his illustrations, his motifs are widely known, although many younger people may not know who he was. But it's Keith Haring, Haring. He recently had a big retrospective at the Brooklyn Museum, and of early work. But he was
brilliant.
Yeah.
I remember seeing him drawing his pictograms on black signs in the subway. What happens is when ads are pulled down, they put up a piece of black paper, mm-hmm. and he would go around on the subway with his bicycle and just with white chalk and draw these wonderfully evocative little cartoony mm-hmm. pictograms.
Yep. His radiant baby is one of the biggest,
yes.
the most iconic of those. So one of the other musicians that we lost was Sylvester. And before there was a RuPaul, there was Sylvester. Sylvester was the first drag queen to become famous in this country, at least. And his producer, Patrick Cowley, was also lost to HIV and AIDS. He did a lot of electronic music that was at the time called high energy. So we're going to play a little track. This is Sylvester from 1978, You Make Me Feel Mighty Real, and this is produced by Patrick Cowley.
I feel it.
So that is the amazing Sylvester. Sylvester was lost to AIDS along with his producer, Patrick Cowley. If you don't know Sylvester, or even if you do, go to YouTube and check out this track, because it is such a time capsule, and you'll see that Sylvester was really way, way, way before his time, although the video is definitely of the moment in 1978. But it's really worth it. It's worth checking it out. Sylvester, You Make Me Feel Mighty Real. So we talked a little bit about treatment, and particularly in third world countries. So I wanted to just talk a little bit about treatment now, both in this country and elsewhere. Clearly, the invention or the discovery of protease inhibitors and getting those drugs into people's bodies, which happened in 1996, when the what they at the time called the drug cocktail, which was a number of different drugs targeting different areas of the replication of the virus, and that changed the game for in HIV.
Was that able to plug in to the T cell?
Well, it's the receptor. It interfered with the receptors where the virus infects the cells, and everything changed in 96. Now there's obviously still problems with treatment. Some people don't respond to treatments that are available. Some people can't take them because they're too toxic. Although toxicity has been lessened over the course of time when drug companies were able to understand that a lower dosage of the drug was just as effective as the higher dosages, which people were having a lot of trouble with. But there's been some major advances in the last, I guess, 2 years as well, which for people who are, say, in a serodiscordant relationship, where one person is positive and one person is negative, studies have found that a drug called Truvada actually prevents infection from occurring, and so that is called pre-exposure prophylaxis, in order to protect the negative person in a relationship like that. One of the things that I think people don't really understand is that IV drug users, intravenous drug users, in general, want to protect themselves and want clean needles and don't want to become HIV positive. A lot of people think that people who use IV drugs are just ready, they just don't care about themselves. And what studies have found is that when people have access to clean needles, they use them. And Truvada is also a drug for IV drug users who are not ready to get clean, but still don't want to have HIV. That's another option for them as well. The studies have also found, and this is a very big change, in the beginning of the crisis, when women were infected, the child was almost always infected as well. And now, using the drugs during pregnancy, actually prevents transmission to the baby. I think at the president's news conference, he used the number 1 million children born HIV negative to HIV positive mothers around the world. And I think that's a huge advance. And that particular that initiative, particularly in the third world countries and particularly in Africa, was actually an initiative of George H.W. Bush, the first President Bush, who really saw the crisis and the need to treat the developing world as well as the developed world. And to his credit, he really changed the game in HIV and AIDS around the world, and I know a lot of people who think I'm extremely partisan would think that I would never be praising a Republican president, but this was an initiative that changed the game in global AIDS, and I think that's a huge thing.
Yeah, I think the Sun too was instrumental in helping with that.
Absolutely.
And I think the Gates Foundation is also working.
Yeah. I mean, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been done amazing work around the world, not just with HIV, but with malaria and TB, tuberculosis, and a number of other treatable diseases that people don't have to die from, particularly with children dying of diarrhea, which is just crazy that in our country we don't think of that as an illness, but around the world, more kids die from diarrhea than they do from almost anything else in the developing world. So that's when you have foundations and philanthropists that see global health as as the thing that they want to focus on, it's pretty incredible. I mean, they've done great work.
It's no longer a death sentence.
Yeah, absolutely. Locally, if you want to get tested, if you are HIV positive and you need services or you need access to insurance, the AIDS Council of Northeastern New York, and I'm a member of the board of the AIDS Council, has a Hudson office. It's actually in Greenport, but at Fairview Plaza. But if you need services, I'll announce their phone number toward the end of the show, and have a pen and paper ready. And if you just want to get tested either for HIV or for other sexually transmitted diseases, you can access those services at the AIDS Council. If you need services, either public assistance or help with Social Security or any other access to care or services, they can help you with that as well. So I'll give you that number in a few minutes. But their website is aidscouncil.org, and they do amazing work. And I've been a client, and I've been on the board, and they've been great help to me. And if you need those services, they're really amazing. It's an amazing organization. I'm thrilled to be a part of it.
One advance that's happened during this whole past 25 years is that there weren't safeguards on the blood supply. People would donate blood and it wasn't tested. It was just thrown in the hopper, centrifuged. A lot of hemophiliacs got blood products, some under the name of Factor VIII, that could expose an individual to the blood of maybe 1,000 people. And that is why so many hemophiliacs caught HIV through the blood supply. But now it's tested and is much, much safer than in the past.
And that's another change. That right now the government is working on new regulations. For many years, probably 20 years, HIV positive people were prohibited from donating organs or from donating even blood. Gay men are still banned from donating blood, but which is outrageous as well, because there are more gay men that are uninfected than there are infected, and we need blood, and the blood is all tested, so there's no reason to prohibit gay men from donating. But the regulations for people donating organs is about to be revised because there are many people who are HIV positive who need an organ and they can't get them because they are low on the list because they have HIV, and there's no reason why organs couldn't be transmitted, donated and shared by two people who are HIV positive. So that's coming down the pike. It's one of the things that the president addressed in his press conference on Monday. And
that's good news.
That's a great advance.
Because many people who have been infected with AIDS also have hepatitis C.
Yeah.
And that is a disease that affects the liver and has increased the need across the whole population for liver transplants. But the good news there is I hear there's better treatment than ever before for that.
And with Hep C, one of the things about hepatitis C is that unlike HIV, which at the moment is not curable, hepatitis C can actually be cured with the proper treatment if it's caught early enough. So, and that's something that the AIDS Council could help you with as well. If you are if you're Hep C positive, and you want to get into treatment, there's ways of doing that as well, and it's really well worth checking out because you could be free of your Hep C infection.
That's a sleeper disease that people can have for decades without any symptoms, and then all of a sudden, hello, you need a new liver.
Yeah,
it's
So one of the other people lost to HIV was David Cole, and David Cole was part of CNC Music Factory, but toward the end of his life created another band with Robert Clavillis called Clavillis and Cole. They were big in the club music scene. They did some of the most iconic tracks of the late 90s and early 2000s. And we're going to play Pride, A Deeper Love, which has become, a big gay anthem and is one of these tracks that is all about being proud of who you are and loving yourself. So this is A Deeper Love by Clavillis and Cole. So that is Pride, A Deeper Love by Clavillis and Cole. David Cole was lost to HIV in the 2000s and was a prolific songwriter and producer. Produced many of like Whitney Houston tracks and was a great loss to the world of dance music and club music. So we've just got a couple of minutes left. There's a couple of issues that you'd like to talk about before we close it up.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about, you know, how far we've come, and how back in the early 90s, when the senior in high school that my husband and I chronicled in our film Eagle Scout, got AIDS, he really didn't have a future. He didn't go to college. Shortly after we finished our film, he developed AIDS-related dementia, which you don't hear about that happening mm-hmm. too much anymore. I think the drugs are helping people live a full life for a lot longer, a full life
for most people. For most people, but certainly, yeah. people, you know, anybody who thinks that it's over is mistaken.
People still die of AIDS.
Right.
But a few years ago, Henry's father wrote a book called Henry for President, and that just conjures up images of when you have a little baby, you think of he could go anywhere, mm-hmm. he or she could mm-hmm. even become president. And AIDS just cuts off that future. This kid didn't have a career. He didn't have a love relationship. And he didn't have a future. Mm-hmm. And so much has changed. You know, he lived a decade or two later, he would have. Yeah. He would have had a future. So there's a cause for hope and celebration, yep. definitely.
So be happy that you live in this time and not a little earlier. And for younger people, I think it's, you know, while it's still important to use a condom, and if you're using IV drugs, to certainly use clean needles, but the time that we're living in now is a much less desperate and sad time, and it's I know for myself, who've been, I, you know, I got tested in 1989 and was HIV positive, so I may have been positive for a number of quite a bit longer than that, so you know, I'm going on almost 30 years to 25 years lost track, but to, you know, at the time I certainly didn't expect to be here in 2013 in Hudson, New York, on the radio, and
running for mayor.
Exactly.
And so, you look great. Do you feel
you.
Good?
I
do you
feel
as good as
it's
you look?
Yeah, it's been a long struggle, and there's been, it's a roller coaster, but I'm so happy with where I'm at right now, and for people out there who have never been tested, that's I'm an example of why testing is important, because you can live a long and productive life and do well. And so if you've never been tested, or if you were tested a long time ago and you haven't been recently, I really encourage you to get tested, and if you are positive, get into treatment and look for support. There are many support groups as well, I said I would give you the contact information for the AIDS Council, and the Hudson office is 518-828-3624. That office isn't staffed 100% of the time, so if you want to get in touch with the Albany office, that's where everything is run out of, and that number is 518-434-4686. And again, it's AIDSCouncil.org. is the website, and you can find out all that information there as well. And it's really important to get tested and to get into treatment if you're positive, and keep a positive outlook about it, and understand that that treatment is the best way to help yourself and to do well. And it's tremendously important. So I'm not sure what's happening next here on the radio, but let's see, we've got 2 minutes.
I'd just like to say the reason we're here now at this place, where there is a great deal more hope than there was, is the activism of both the gay and the straight community.
Yeah.
But that's the straight supporting the gays and following their lead, and they've been heroes. They are my heroes.
Yeah, and as me as well. I was very involved with ACT UP at the time, and it is some of the work in my life that I am the most proud of, because ultimately that fight saved millions of lives. And
yeah.
And it's
this
just
is a picture of Hunter Reynolds, and doesn't he look great?
Uh-huh. Absolutely. And check out Hunter Reynolds online and see some of his work, is because it's really incredible, and it's real well worth the look.
And he's also involved up in Troy, where he leads a camp for gay kids.
Uh-huh.
And there's a gay arts retreat up there.
And that's at Hillside, right?
I think so.
Hillside is a campground for I think it's mostly for gay men, but I think it's also mixed, and it runs the gamut.
Mm-hmm. It's exciting
of things there. So I guess we're going to wrap it up. Deborah, thank you so much. We've been with Deborah Gilbert, who is a writer for the Columbia Paper and a town board member in Taconic. And so nice to have you back on the show, and maybe we can do it more often. I'd love it.
Thanks.
This has been At Issue. I'm Victor Mandolia. I'll be back in 2 weeks here on WGXE 90.7 FM.